Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Donal McIntyre, and this is Murderers and Their Mothers, the companion podcast to the CBS reality series, which airs every Sunday from the 15th of May at 10 p.m. Throughout this series, we're investigating some of the world's most notorious killers and asking, were these murderers born evil, or did their relationships with their own mothers make them into monsters? On today's episode, we look at the case of Robert Black, a man who was every parent's nightmare. Following a nationwide manhunt, he was convicted of the murder of four young girls in the 1980s. However, he is linked to the murders of at least 15 more. But what drove Robert Black to be Britain's most prolific child killer? Well, joining me to discuss Robert Black are Dr. Elizabeth Yardley, Director of the Centre for Applied Criminology at Birmingham City University.
Hello.
And also clinical forensic psychologist, Dr. Mike Berry.
Thank you.
Robert Black was born on the 21st of May 1947 in Falkirk, Scotland. However, he was an illegitimate child, a shameful act in the 1940s, and was abandoned by his mother. He was initially put up for adoption, but instead, aged just 6 months, he was placed in the foster care of Jack and Isabel Tulip in the Highland town of Kinlochleven. Well, talk about the social stigma in relation to Robert Black. We've seen social stigma attached to the families of other serial killers. Why is this important that he's an illegitimate child, Mike?
Go back to when he was born. It was very much the case that you got married and you had children. You didn't have children out of wedlock. So he would have been seen as dodgy, to say the least. It would have been, his mother would have been seen as somebody of low moral status, and by default, the child would have been seen as of low moral standard as well.
And it's what his mother goes on to do afterwards that really kind of twists the knife in for Robert Black, because she goes on to marry and have four other children, and she never sees Robert ever again. So it is quite a significant episode.
And the concept of fostering, the fact it's a halfway house, I mean, some people would take a child and they would adopt their child who was initially there in foster care. Is he aware of the transient position he's in?
I think the one thing you have to remember is fostering, you got money, adoption, you didn't. So it was seen very much as a useful income. So we have this child who's a bit difficult, therefore the authorities are not going to be too fussy about who the fostering parents are going to be. And it's a win-win situation for the foster parents.
And what are the emotional scars that abandonment by his mother will leave on him?
This idea that he's been, you know, abandoned by his natural mother and he's with these people who are caring for him because they're paid to do so, it is quite a significant thing, isn't it?
Now, Mike, he's not only abandoned, but also he has abuse inflicted upon him at this foster home.
Yes, they seem to have been quite violent parents. Now, the problem is, are they using violence to exert a certain amount of discipline on an unruly boy, or are they getting sadistic pleasure out of the violence they're inflicting on him? We don't know.
This is interesting point, isn't it? Because now, you know, any kind of violence towards children is completely abhorrent and not tolerated. But back then, there was some tolerance of a level of physical discipline, you know, to keep kids in line. So where that line was drawn, you know, between abuse and between discipline was quite a blurry one.
And of course, he's seen covered in bruises within the community and nobody shouts stop.
No, exactly. So you've got to wonder what's going on here.
But you would have had the situation where other people said, don't spare the rod. And, you know, if the child needs a good thrashing, you give him a damn good thrashing.
Well, let's hear more about his life with his foster parents. Here's forensic psychologist Kerry Danes.
He was punished for bedwetting, and that would have led to anxiety about loss of control, because if he loses control, he's going to be beaten for it. But also harsh punishments provide a role model. They provide a blueprint of behaviour. So he would have seen violence as normal, really. That becomes central later on to his sexual fantasies and his wanting to project fear onto others.
Now, the punishment he suffered, he was punished at the at his foster parents. He was punished by the Tulips for bedwetting. And what kind of anxieties would that impose upon him, Liz?
Well, that's going to be, you know, a really awful thing to experience, because most children, when they wet the bed, they're comforted by their parents. They're told it's okay, don't worry, and you know, we'll get through it. And they try various things, you know, to get them out of that kind of behaviour. But he's punished for it, and that's just going to make him even more anxious and even more likely to wet the bed.
But he's also much older. He's older than when most children, by the time they get to school, you'd expect them to be dry most nights. He's wet and he's much older than that, so he is going to be attacked by the foster parents, and either verbally or, in this case, physically as well.
What is it about him that, and I'm sure it's a question he asked himself, what is it about him that invites all this abuse and fear?
He is not a very appealing boy. If you want to survive in a foster home, you've got to be funny, or you've got to be appealing, you've got to be obedient. He doesn't seem to have any of those characteristics.
What red flags are we seeing in his childhood at this early stage that might suggest that there would be problems in his in the future?
I certainly would take note of the bedwetting. The older he is, the more worrying bedwetting is. And you'd say, well, that indicates somebody with a high level of anxiety. What's happening in this child's life that is causing that anxiety? I wouldn't be looking at him being deviant yet, but I would be looking at what's going on in his life. And I would have thought people would be thinking about the foster home, the parents, that kind of response, not any response from him.
And of course, at the age of five, his foster dad dies. And of course, it's perhaps the only male role model he knows in his life. How does he cope with that?
This is a particularly troubling time for him, because, you know, when Robert Tulip dies and he's out of the picture, he's in the sole care of his foster mother, Margaret. And she's not a particularly warm parent by any stretch of the imagination.
Within the home, after the death of his foster father, is there a sense that he's desperately striving for more and more affection from his mother, foster mother, and is never going to get it?
It's highly unlikely he would have got it from her. She comes across as a rather cold character to start with. She's not got any great warmth and affection towards him. She has her own grief to go through, and she's presumably grieving about the loss of her husband while trying to hold a family together, and probably financial loss as well that she's got to consider. So she's under a great deal of pressure.
To what extent is it going to amplify the absence of his own mother from his own life? Now he's kind of effectively emotionally abandoned by his own foster mother.
Well, I think here's a young lad who's just taking each day as it comes and coping with whatever life puts in front of him on any particular day. So I'm not sure he's kind of thinking, you know, in terms of that bigger picture that we tend to take when we look back on it.
At a very young age, Mike, Black becomes fascinated by genitalia. How does this manifest itself?
Well, people say he's fascinated, but I think most kids are at five. Show me yours, I'll show you mine. And you go first is quite common. You hear that with children. They're going to want to know, why is a girl different than a boy, and what have you done playing with yours that you've lost it, and things like that. So I don't see that's worrying at all at that age. Later on, he should have developed, and he doesn't. What's interesting, he seems to have had this kind of fixation on young girls. It's interesting, even one of his older victims was 15, but was only 4'11" and would pass as a much younger girl. So it's kind of around about age 8, 9, 10, he's age fixed, and then he doesn't move on. Where most males will then move on to adults, women and things like that, he's kind of stuck at that age group.
Liz, do you think we're lending too much significance into this childhood fascination with genitalia?
Well, I mean, we can look back and we can make anything meaningful that doesn't carry a lot of meaning when we're looking back at the life of a serial killer. But I think what it's suggesting to me is perhaps that there wasn't that that sort of confrontation of his behaviour. So normally, you know, when children are talking about their genitalia and saying, you know, you show me yours and I'll show you mine, you know, parents step in and say, hang on a minute, you know, that's not acceptable. You're not allowed to do things like that. And that kind of puts a lid on that behaviour.
Or you're brought up in a family where nudity is accepted, where people get in the baths, the children get in the baths with the parents to a certain age, and then the child, usually about 7 or 8, wants to have their privacy. But when they're very young, they often just dive into the bath when parents are in the bath. So they would have seen it and not had the big issue. If it's secret, and I imagine it would be in this kind of Scottish background where it's very kind of conservative, we are talking about 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, a very conservative background, then it would be more exciting.
Well, as we've been hearing, the young Robert Black had a rough start in life, and at school, things don't get much better. He's often bullied and also begins to show increasingly alarming behaviour. Why is he picked out and bullied, Mike?
He's referred to as Smelly Tulip. He doesn't take a lot of interest in his hygiene, so kids don't like smelly kids, first of all. He's not particularly physically attractive. He's not skilled at sports. He's not got many things that children like in other children. And he hasn't got a mummy and a daddy. And kids, that generation, expected you to have a mother and a father. And he's different. He's in a foster home. He hasn't got the right history. And I suspect parents on the side are also saying, don't play with him, dear. Go and play with Jimmy down the road or Margaret down the road or whatever, because they're from a better family.
Well, Liz, what impact does this have on him, this stigma?
Well, he's a kid who doesn't look like other kids, who isn't from the same background that other kids are from, and he's stigmatised because of that. So I think it's this ongoing sense of isolation. He doesn't have any allies at home, and he certainly doesn't have any allies at school, so he's very much on his own.
Around the age of 8, it's thought that he starts to chase girls to look up their skirts. Is this innocent or something more sinister? Because he's not the type of popular kid who might get away with that kind of behaviour in a schoolyard.
I think that's it. He wasn't popular, therefore people would complain about it. But I don't think we should read too much into it. I think it's more of irritation. He's probably doing it to irritate the girls because they're not nice to him, rather than any predatory sexual behaviour. I think he's far too young for that.
You don't think there's any kind of pathological significance in the fact that when he's looking after a baby or cradling it, he takes it to another room so we can look at its bits, its genitalia?
Yeah, that's an interesting episode, isn't it? And it's another one of these where let's attach lots of meaning to it now, kind of in the aftermath. How old was he when that occurred?
Well, around 8. But I mean, as much as you might lend much significance to that, I think one certainly would kind of raise alarm bells when he starts putting all sorts of objects up his rectum. I mean, this is learned behaviour. This says to me that something was very amiss in that foster home.
What says to me is that somebody's done it to him. I think, you know, a child is unlikely, even though they're exploring the rectal passage, they're unlikely to stick anything up that's painful. But what he's doing, I suspect, is repeating what's already been done to him.
I mean, today, that would be, people would think, CSA, child sexual abuse, there's something here, this is learned behaviour. And certainly social services would be racing into a case like this today, but not then, of course.
No, absolutely. And we're looking at children who are brutalised, essentially, by the people who are supposed to be looking after them. And we're assuming, you know, there's this assumption that foster parents are caring for children, you know, that they're doing right by them. And there's this idea of the privacy of the family as well, that it's actually none of our business how people are bringing up their kids.
So now we imagine that he's suffered child sexual abuse while in foster care at home. And now he suffers another tragedy. His foster mother dies and he's now placed within the care system. And the care system back then, you know, even today, isn't much of a good parent.
No, it's a very brutalised institution where you're dealing with 10, 11 and 12-year-olds who often have health problems, have mental health problems, have family dynamics to resolve. It's not a nice place, and you're dealing with very often very inexperienced staff.
Robert is now showing displays of violence, especially towards girls, it's reported at this stage. Is this grief, or is it something more sinister? Is it an amplification of the abuse he suffered earlier?
I think it's likely to be an extension of the abuse he's getting or has received in his recent history. I don't see it as a grief reaction at all. I don't see it that way. I see it very much as a sexual behaviour. Now, whether it's response to abuse to him or it's driven by his own interests is debatable. But so, I don't think it's grief.
Well, he's gone from a situation where he's been abused himself by his caregivers, and now he's entered an environment where there are lots of other children who've experienced similar things like that. So it becomes a very toxic environment.
And chronologically, he now moves from one care home to an all-boys care home because he's proved to be too sexually aware. And he goes to this all-boys care home and he's abused by a member of staff there for 3 years. I mean, that would have had a devastating impact upon the future of Robert Black.
One thing, we concentrate a lot on mothers, and rightly so, but what we often forget is the importance of the father. And going back 50 years ago, McCord was saying this is the lack of a father is a good indicator of criminality. So here we have a loss of a father, because he never had one natural father, a loss of a foster father, now we've got a loss of a foster mother, and we've got a substitute father in the institution who, instead of caring, loving and being protective, is actually abusing him. So he's got a very screwed up perception of what's right and what's wrong.
Yes, that's right, isn't he? He must have no concept of what normal actually is.
Well, the abuse and neglect and violence have become completely normalised for him, and I think it's something that he comes to expect.
Aged 15, Robert Black leaves that all-boys care home and enters the big wide world and gets his first job as a butcher's delivery driver. Black now has his first real sense of freedom, but begins to show some worrying tendencies. He begins to watch and follow young girls, and we believe that he may have fondled around 30 to 40 young girls in this period.
What's worrying about the fact that he starts fondling these girls is he gets away with it. So it's not having his hand slapped, taken into court, saying this is not done. He's actually, A, being successful in his criminal behaviour. He's having no boundaries set for him. So he's learned that he can get away with it.
And aged 15 or 16, he doesn't seem to be able to have the skills to get a girlfriend of his own.
No, I mean, he clearly wants sex, but he doesn't have those social skills to begin a relationship and have a relationship that evolves normally. So he just goes out to get, you know, what he wants.
And he's also been in an all-male institution. I mean, there no doubt will be female staff, but he's not having the opportunity to make all those kind of social gaffes that you do when you're a teenage boy. He's not doing that. Young girls are more compliant because they don't know what he's about to do to them. He can physically deal with them. So that's why. And as we said earlier on, he's got this eight, 9-year-old fixation because that was the last time he had any sexual experience that he enjoyed. So he's going to go and repeat that.
And do you think that he realised his behaviour was abnormal?
Well, it's what has he had to compare it against? I mean, I think that there is going to be some realisation that actually, you know, what he's doing is unacceptable because he's going out there in the world, he's engaging it in work, in an occupation. But it's an occupation in which he's alone quite a lot of the time, isn't it?
And for the very first time, age 16, he gets arrested for abusing a girl in Greenock, but is let off with a caution for lewd and libidinous behaviour. Does this empower him to think he can get away with much more?
Yes, without doubt. He's had, by his own self-confessions, 30 or 40 girls that he's sexually assaulted. He then gets caught and gets a slapped hand and nothing much more than that. So he can get away with it.
He tries then to get a sense of normality, and after this brush with the law, Black moves to Grangemouth and takes a low-paid menial job at a building firm. And here we see a change in that he does begin a relationship with his first and only girlfriend. He meets Pamela Hodgson outside a youth club and they hit it off and she accepts his proposal of marriage. However, the relationship ends after Pamela is simply unable to cope with his odd behaviour and strange sexual demands.
As I understand it, he met this girl, he became infatuated with her, far too quickly suggested marriage and asked her to marry, and I suspect she just was scared off by that because she was young, he was young. I think he had no boundaries again as to what you do in a relationship, and he went far too fast.
Do you think he thought that this was his chance to escape his other offending behaviour?
I don't know whether he's seeing it as anything that's kind of fundamentally out of order. I mean, it's something that he's used to. It's something that he wants to do. So I think he's just going to try and find more opportunities to have power over other people in that way.
And now he has suffered rejection at the hands of somebody he was very much obsessed with. What impact does that have upon him? Because, of course, he's been rejected all his life.
He goes down back to what he knows. Resort to younger females where he can successfully have some form of sexual relationship with them. However bizarre it is to the rest of the world, he would perceive it as being acceptable to him.
Could he have had ever a successful relationship with Pamela? Was that a possible opportunity?
I mean, you got to think about what is the normal progression of a relationship when you're in your late teens. And even, you know, sometimes teenagers' relationships are quite intense and quite fiery, and they blow up very quickly. But I think even he was just too quick off the mark here, and because he just didn't know what those normal, you know, patterns of behaviour are when you're first getting together with somebody.
Well, days after his engagement has broken off, Black is caught interfering with his landlady's granddaughter. Although not reported to police, he's run out of town by the locals. But he can't help himself, and in 1967, just a month shy of his 20th birthday, Black is incarcerated for indecent assault. He ends up in Borstal, Liz.
Yeah, he's back in an institution again, isn't he? And there are obviously going to be lads in there from similar backgrounds to him. So this is not a good thing for him at all.
He's not going to get any treatment. He's not going to be there long enough to have sex therapy that he clearly needed. All that's happening is he's there, he's being held in the institution for X number of months and then kicked out. No treatment, so all that happens is he gets fitter and angrier and cleverer.
Well, after leaving Borstal, he heads to London and anonymity. He settles in King's Cross, an area of seedy sex shops and brothels. And here he finds easy access to some disturbing imagery and material. Here's author Tim Tate.
Child pornography is the wrong phrase, but it's the one we're stuck with. Child pornography conjures up an image of pornography. It isn't. It's the pictorial record of sexual assaults against children. For men like Black, it didn't replace, it never replaces contact offending with children. It reinforces it. It makes it okay because it's there in print or on celluloid.
So the issue of Black engaging with pornographic images at this stage, he's still quite young, he's suffered sexual abuse, he's committed sexual crimes. Is this like crack cocaine to him?
Well, I'm not sure about crack cocaine, but certainly it depends on what material he's getting and how deviant the sexual behaviour is. But by that time, I would imagine he's getting pictures and possibly even films of child abuse, and then he's enjoying watching that. It's likely he will masturbate to that, which reinforces the whole cycle of sexual abuse.
Yeah, it's the ability to watch the kind of things that he wants to do that's constantly reinforcing it for him. And nothing's there challenging him, you know, saying that this is inappropriate and you should stop this. He's able to develop and escalate.
In London, Black becomes friendly with Edward and Catherine Rayson, and he rents a room off them. He will share their house for 20 years and appears to be a good tenant, even helping out with babysitting duties for the brood of kids. Now, is there a sense he's trying to curb his urges here? He's doing his darts, he's trying to fit in, he's doing some photography. By all accounts, he appears to be looking for stability and be quite normal.
No,
he's looking for opportunities to offend, isn't he?
So this must have been part cover for his future behaviours, Liz.
I just think it was an opportunity for him. You know, he places himself within a family home quite deliberately, doesn't he? And I think that there were other opportunities. Yeah, he could have gone and lodged with people who didn't have kids. He could have gone and put himself up in a hostel. But no, he chose to go into this environment for a reason.
Well, if we're to believe police, by 1976, we believe Black had abstained from molesting children for 10 years, although he is clearly a consumer of child porn. I'd find it difficult to believe he did abstain for that long.
No, he wouldn't have done. We know the pattern. We know that sex offenders do not stop. they don't get caught. And if you look at all the research in the States and Canada and the UK, if you ask a sex offender and you give them immunity, they will tell you a completely different story, that they are sexually offending every day, but they have maybe 6 months, a couple of years of non-offending behaviour according to the law, but according to the offenders, they're at it all the time. They're not going to... He's young. He's sexually active. He's not going to live in a monastery for 10 years.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
In 1976, he also purchases a wide van and begins life as a delivery driver. And he's now free to roam the country. Using this as cover, it's believed that in 1978, he abducted and killed Jeanette Tate in Devon, and her body has never been found. So the fact that he's gone and escalated from abusing and molesting children to killing, why has he done this?
Yeah, I disagree with you with the white van. I think the white van was more to do with the work opportunity. He was able to get a job as a driver. He also, when he worked for these firms, would work at weekends and odd times that other people didn't want to work. If you're a family man, you don't necessarily want to work weekends. He also went to Northern Ireland during what we call the Troubles. So he was going to places that other people didn't want to go to. That allowed him money, allowed him freedom and opportunity. But I don't see the white van was brought to abduct children. I see that as being an extension of his work life. The opportunity was that he had transport.
I get the opportunity. It's not, that's not the point I'm making. The point is the drivery, the fact as a delivery driver has given an opportunity to develop and spend all these long hours developing and feeding his fantasies. And so at some stage, an opportunity would walk past his way and then he can use it. And so it's quite interesting. The occupation of a delivery driver may have facilitated this, not in terms of just the fact that he had a van, but also he had the time to unravel and deduce his fantasies, Liz.
No, you could argue that he had less opportunity. Because if he's driving the places, he doesn't know where kids are going to be and things like that. If he was working down the road and he could see the school kids or whatever, he would get to know them, he could build up contact. If he's on the road, he's on his own for a lot of the time, he's not going to have opportunity to build up relationships. OK, he has the opportunity, he creates an opportunity by abducting children, but I think that was an extension of his sexual behaviour rather than... pre-planned in that sense.
You don't think he's got hours, opportunity to fantasize? That's what these guys do, no?
Yeah, but why not sit down and watch the video at home?
There's no video at home. He's in the car. He's in the
delivery.
He's got hours driving from London all the way up to Scotland. Liz?
Well, I think what he found appealing about this job as a delivery driver is that he doesn't have to interact with other people very much. And this is somebody who really doesn't like interacting with other people. He just doesn't have the social skills to do so. And I think maybe during the course of that employment, these opportunities present themselves.
Yeah. And why is he escalating now to murdering children rather than molesting?
Well, it is that escalation of behaviour. You know, unless there's a break put on it, and unless they get caught and there's some kind of consequence, then it is only going to get worse.
But we need to look at what was the turning point, because a lot of sex offenders never escalate. They carry on sexually assaulting young children for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, unfortunately. Why did he go? Because he wanted more excitement. I suspect the pornography wasn't fulfilling the job. I suspect also it was a mistake the first time. I've come across sex offenders who have abducted children, put a hand over their mouth, and the child has gone unconscious or whatever, and actually unintentionally harmed them. And then develop that as part of the next attack, is that when they get a child, they then purposely make them unconscious. And from then onwards, you start to see that movement to the more sexual violence, and then the killing. And then the other thing is, he doesn't want to get caught. So he gets a point where he's got to kill the victim because he's going to get caught.
And he becomes really quite adept at this. Snatch, kidnap, abuse, murder.
He does, because he doesn't have those social skills that you'd need to what we call groom a child, yeah. Does he? So it is this snatch and grab approach, because he's unable to kind of lure them in by other means.
But also, go back 30, 40 years ago, we didn't have stranger danger, which I think is wrong, actually. Mm-hmm. You're more likely to be abused by your family and your mum's fancy man than almost anybody else at a very young age. But we didn't have that danger that we have now. Children don't go and play on the streets quite so much. They are much more aware, not sexual assault, but aware of what they do and what they don't do. And I think parents are much more controlling now than they were in those days.
I think the idea of risk hadn't really developed to the degree that it has today. I mean, the world was seen as a safer place, wasn't it?
Well, many murders followed this very first killing. Between 1981 and 1986, Black kidnapped, sexually assaulted and killed at least four girls between the ages of 5 and 11, but he's thought that he may have killed at least 15 more. He was finally caught in 1990 as he attempted to abduct a six-year-old child in the village of Stowe in Scotland. Now, the escalation, well, just to return to that point, why do you think he did escalate from child molester to child murderer? Is it because he could?
He could. And I think he needed it for his own sexual satisfaction and excitement. Also, if you look at the victims, they were abused a lot more. There was a lot more physical abuse as time went on. And I think he had to get to the stage where he would have to kill them. The other interesting thing is that he had a killing kit with him. He had the ropes, he had all the equipment he needed in a bag. So while whoever the victim was may have been opportunistic, he clearly had the plan in his head to abduct a child and to kill a child.
Going back to his childhood and look at the toxic combination of abandonment multiple times, the death and grief, child sexual abuse, that anal penetration, some suggestion of abuse in his foster home and then in the other boy's home. You know, was he always doomed to be a sexual predator or a sexual perpetrator?
Well, I think we have to look at children who experience, you know, abuse and neglect and violence during their childhoods. Not all of them will go on to harm other people. But I think in the case of Robert Black, we've got so many other toxic factors that are in the mix there. We've got, you know, him entering the care system and he's certainly not getting any kind of support there. You know, he's ostracised in terms of his peers. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Well, going back to his mother, do you think if he had been part of that brood of four and he hadn't been the abandoned one, do you think he would have had a very different life?
Oh, without any doubt. If he'd been loved and cared for by a father and a mother and in a loving relationship, and not being abused, he would have, no doubt, would have been different. But it's the circumstances. And the problem is, we can look back and say, these are the factors that influenced him. But what we can't often do is look futuristically and say, if we don't do this and this, this person is going to kill.
It seems he was let down by his mother most profoundly. And of course, all the other adults that were brought in that surrogate parents role also let him down, physically abused him or sexually abused him. I mean, what impact did that have on the crimes he would later commit?
Well, I think he's, you know, completely unable to have, you know, those respectful adult relationships with appropriate boundaries. He's living at a whole different value system to the rest of us. But he's very aware of that, I think. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing is wrong. And he's determined he's not going to get caught.
It's clear to me there were moments when he could have been stopped.
No, because you have the law, which would have been certain offences would have been maximum of, say, 12 months, 24 months imprisonment. He would have probably done 6 to 8 months in prison or Borstal or in some institution. That's not enough time to engage him in therapy. If he was recognised as a sex offender and was willing, and this is the problem, a lot of sex offenders aren't willing to get treatment. If he's willing to get treatment, you're looking at 2-3 years in the system. And the system isn't built for short-term intervention.
How come he got away with it for so long?
Because people didn't recognise the pattern. I mean, he was very clever in the sense of killing in Northern Ireland, killing in Scotland, killing in the Midlands. We had 48 police forces in England at the time, and then they were more than Scotland, there's only one now. But they had a problem that police forces didn't interact with each other. You weren't expecting a killing in Scotland to have any relationship to one in Northern Ireland. And the other thing, one of his children was only five, one of his victims, and at five, the prospects are that you're going to be killed by your parents or carers or babysitters or something like that, not a complete stranger. So again, you've got a five-year-old and people are looking at nearest and dearest. They're not looking at complete strangers.
Final question. In this era of pornography so pervasive, are we going to see more killers like Robert Black or less?
Well, I think we're in a slightly different environment now, aren't we? I think we're more aware of people when they come onto the radar of the criminal justice system in terms of what behaviour might indicate in the future. But at the same time, we've also got this kind of dark underworld on the internet where people can meet up and connect with others with similar kind of deviant fantasies. So that is worrying for me.
Yeah, I mean, we've identified in some research that we've been involved in, which shows a hierarchy where a lot of porn is passed between ordinary porn-interested men and women, and then you get a hierarchy where the top ones are dealing in very high-quality, very obscene pornography, where there's very small groups of people who are trading with each other thousands and thousands of images. And with a computer, with an ordinary USB, you can transport horrendous amounts of porn from one person's machine to another. And these are people who are dealing at very, very high level.
Would this mean more murderers like Robert Black or less?
There was an argument that if you watch porn, you will become a sex offender. There's an equal argument that watching porn will not make you a sex offender. You need to have other factors going on in your life, all those coming together. Are we likely to have another Robert Black? No. The reason I say that is because I think the police are much more communicative than they were before. I think they're much, certainly with Holmes, so the computer system, they would recognise crimes, I think, at a much earlier stage. I would hope that we're actually going to get a situation where crime would be detected, the pattern would be detected easier.
Yeah, I think the police have closed a lot of those gaps that offenders like Robert Black used to fall through. Yeah. So I think in today's society with the joined up policing that we see now, you know, there may be offenders like this, but they wouldn't get away with it for as long as Robert Black did.
Well, nice to end on a positive note after such a horrific story. Black died in prison when police were just months away from charging him with yet another murder. Well, thank you to my guests, Dr. Elizabeth Yardley and Mike Berry. And of course, you can watch the full documentary Murderers and Their Mothers, Robert Black, on CBS Reality. Next time we'll be looking at the complex case of Leszek Penkalski. From me, Donal McIntyre, it's goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.